All right, back from holidays and preaching on the fire of hell. Years ago, I heard I went to a Planet Shakers conference. It was held in Sydney, and I heard a preacher, a young guy, a talented singer, and very engaging communicator. And he told the story about how he was on his way to the conference that day, and he was preaching at the conference. He was on his way, and he saw a guy on the side of the road that was kind of waving people down, looking for some help. And he drove past him, and he said in his head, "I'm like speaking at this conference. I got to get there. That's a priority. You know, this is kind of like a big deal. I don't have time to stop and help someone." And then he said he was just really convicted, and he was like, really, maybe God wants me to help this guy in this moment. And so he said that he turned around, he went back, he picked this guy up, helped him get somewhere that he wanted to go before he came over to the conference. And it was, you know, it's a story I remember. I don't remember much from his talk that day, but I remember that story of this guy who was really convicted to have compassion on someone in need in a moment that was actually quite inconvenient for him to have compassion in that moment. A few years later, it was announced that this preacher had cancer and he was unwell. He came back to Sydney another time for another conference, and this time he had an oxygen bottle and an airline. I went and heard him speak again. He sung a song that he'd written called Healer, and he preached sitting down. It was a youth rally, so he told everyone, you know, I'm not well, and you know, if you see, you know, blood coming out of my nose, just let me know so I can wipe it away. Of course, all the youth then spent the whole talk watching the shadow under his nose going, is that blood? What's going on here? Unfortunately, it came out not long after that that it was all a lie, that he didn't have cancer. And he was sick, but it wasn't cancer. And he had created this lie to cover up things that were happening in his life, particularly with his covering up with his wife. A porn addiction that he'd been spending money on, and he was trying to cover that up, and this kind of sickness he had escalated. The story escalated out of control until it got to this point. It's really heartbreaking to hear those kinds of things, especially from someone you felt like, you know, you were encouraged by at one point, and it totally undermines, doesn't it, everything they said. It makes me wonder the truth of everything. It makes me wonder if the story of the guy on the side of the road ever even happened. Because what happened in his private life totally affects what we think of his public life. It matters what we do in private versus public. It matters there. There's a genuineness that we expect to be consistent. As we think about, and we've been doing the series, Gospel-Shaped Mercy, as we think about the way the truth of Jesus should transform us to be a people of mercy, that same truth applies. It matters that it's transforming us within and not just something that we're doing externally. You know, even if you think of stories of people that are kind of standout people in history of mercy givers. I mean, the story of Mother Teresa, you know, her critics would actually point to the fact that a lot of the healthcare setup that she did was very under-resourced and in very poor conditions. And there's questions over the great amounts of money that were donated to her missions. And it matters, doesn't it? If those things are true, even though people were cared for along the way, it matters if there's a lack of genuineness there. And so as we think about gospel-shaped mercy, we've been saying this the whole way through, we expect that Jesus is the foundation of that. And that means that this is the good news of Jesus is what is bringing that transformation. What's happening external, it matters of what's happening internal as well. And as we think about this topic of mercy, we want to think about that and what it means to be transformed from within. Because it's not good if things are not as they appear. As we think about that, about mercy, this passage that we just read is one of those kind of standout passages that really puts the weight on acts of mercy. But as we look at that passage, we'll actually find that this passage is not quite what it seems either. When you first read this passage, this is, I mean, we just read it. This is what it sounds like. At first reading, this is what it sounds like the passage is saying. It sounds like it's the end of days. That's what it says. That Jesus is the judge. He's judging. He's separating people. It sounds like the reason for their separation, the point of judgment, is how they treated the disadvantaged. And he's saying, you know, if you showed signs of mercy, you get to go to heaven. And if you didn't show signs of mercy, it sounds like, as you read this passage, it sounds like if you're today worried about the fire of hell, the answer is just make sure you send some money to someone poor this afternoon and you'll be good. That's what it sounds like. And I want to say that's not what it's saying. Firstly, I know that's not what it's saying because it's not consistent with what the good news of Jesus is, that it's not about what we do, but it's about what he has done. So before we even kind of start unpacking it, I have questions over that. But I think it's clear that it's not quite what it seems as we unpack it, that there's something else going on here. And the message is still to be a people of mercy, but the question is, what is the motivation behind that? What is the underlying thing behind that? The difficulty with this passage, it's kind of passage that I think the world around us would grab hold of and say, I mean, do Christians even read this stuff? This says they should be living their life just caring for the poor. That's it. That's what it's about. And if the church just did that, if the church just read this and did that, you know, we wouldn't have all the problems we have with the church. Now, to be fair, we want to feel some of the weight of there's many times we have not been as compassionate and merciful and gracious as we should be. We want to feel that weight, and I want us to feel that weight this morning. But the challenge here is also the motivation. That it's not this picture of do this and that's what your salvation will rely on. So what I want to do, we're going to spend, it's our practice here as a church to work our way through sections of the Bible, and I want to spend a bit of time. I'm going to ask you to do some work with me as we dig into this a bit and figure out what it is really saying here, and then we'll think a little bit about what that means for us. In mercy. And so what I want to say is I want to look at three things that I observe in this passage. We'll look at these three observations and then we'll talk about what that means. This is the first observation. The story starts, as I said, Jesus is, he's the king. He calls himself the Son of Man, but he's talking about himself. He's the king on the throne at the end of the age, and he's the one doing this judgment, this justice that is happening. And separating, this is what he says, verse 32, and he will separate the people as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. This is the first observation I want to have. It's this picture of this shepherd. So the first one is the one doing, it's as a shepherd. This is someone who knows what he's doing with this group of people. And the picture of a shepherd in biblical times is quite an intimate picture. But the real observation here is why they're being separated. They're not being separated due to behavior. It's not separating those that are loving versus those that are unloving. They're being separated according to their identity. It's some are their identity is sheep and some of them are goats. So the first observation is the category by which judgment is being made. The categories are identity categories, not behavior categories. That's the first observation. All right, we continue on. He moves the sheep to his right, which biblically speaking is a position of honour, and the goats go to the left. And then we're told this, verse 34, then the king will say to those on the right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the creation of the world. The second observation I want to make is the timing of this. The reward, the blessing that is issued here is given before any mention of behavior. Right? We've already seen they're categorized by identity. Now they're blessed before we've talked about any kind of evidence of their behavior. In fact, even more than that, it says it's prepared for you from the creation of the world. This is happening even before they've had a chance to have any behavior. Before anything has been done by these sheep and goats, God's plan has been in place. So the timing of this is the second observation we want to make. The third observation, and I'm going to get you to do a little bit more work with me. The third observation comes in the form of three surprises. Here's the first surprise. The first surprise is the word for in verse 35. Jesus gives, the king gives this, what sounds like a reason. He says, for I was hungry, and you know how it goes. He talks about he was hungry and he was fed, he was thirsty, they gave a drink, he was naked, clothed, sick, and they visited. It sounds like, the surprise is, it sounds like the reason for this separation, the judgment is based on the behavior of this kind of love. So the question here is for us to think about, what does this for mean? Is that what it's saying? Is it saying because you did these things? Is it a causation thing? Or is it a clarification thing? Let me give you an example of how for can be used those two ways. You imagine someone's reading out a will and testament, and they say, to this person, I give the house for you were always kind to me and always shown me love. We would say that the inheritance has come because they have done these things. That's the use of for. But let me give you another example. Let's say they say, to this person, I give my house for you are my family and I love you. You see the difference in the way that word is used, the difference in the reasoning attached to that. One of them is much more based on the work of the recipient, and the other is based on who they are in relationship. There's a less of a causation and more of a clarification thing. The question becomes, moving back to the passage, which one is happening in this story? Because it sounds like it's the first one. For I was hungry and you fed me. It sounds like it's the causation thing. I think it's the clarification category. And let me keep going with these three surprises, and it'll give some clarity on why I think that. The second surprise, the first surprise is the for. The second surprise is the when. It's quite surprising. These people that the sheep are confused about this. They are the ones that say, when did we do that? Like, it's quite strange that they've been rewarded for something that they're going, I mean, you feel like you probably should stay quiet, guys. If he's got this wrong, just let it sit. But they ask that question, when is it that we've done that? What's surprising here is that what has happened has not been, this act that's taken place, has not been something they have done in order to earn favour with the king. This has been an unconscious act that the sheep have done. It's been something that's been part of who they are without them even realising it. So that's the first surprise is for, second surprise is when, the third surprise is who. And I think in some ways this is the biggest surprise of all. Jesus says in verse 40, the king says, when you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you were doing it for me. Most certainly, the who that he is talking about is his people, is the church. Throughout the book of Matthew, where we read this, throughout the book, the word the least of these, every time Jesus uses that, he refers to his followers. The second one is the phrase, my brothers and sisters. Every time he uses that, he's talking about his followers. So those two phrases together, it seems undeniable. Jesus is saying, if you showed this acts of mercy to my brothers and sisters, perhaps particularly those that are disadvantaged, that's the who. Now, that's the most surprising bit, because if you go back to the original suggestion of what we might have thought the passage was saying, if the passage is saying, if you're scared of the fire of hell, just show some love, well, we've added a new component to that, right? If that's what the passage meant, it would mean if you're scared of fire of hell today, just make sure you go give some money to a Christian today. Now, that changes. If the world is saying, if Christians only did this, we'd be a better place, I think there'd be a big backpedal at that point and go, whoa, surely, I mean, maybe the church has done a little bit too much of giving to their own crew, right? What's key here is to think about, this is a key changer to the passage, because what Jesus is saying is, this is about how people have treated the church affects their attitude towards him. Those two things are interconnected. Let me give you an example. If you imagine someone's in a second marriage, they're getting married to someone, they've got kids, and their fiance comes to them and says to them, look, I dearly love you, but I just can't love your children. That's a game changer in that relationship, right? That's, you expect a parent to say, look, I love you too, but it's a package deal. My children are part of who I am. And, you know, if that relationship is working between parent and child, that's what you would expect. There's a package deal that comes there. And that's part of what Jesus is saying here. This is tied up here, that loving Jesus means loving his children. So this is not, if you want to get to heaven, just love a few more Christians. What is being said here is that the identifying marker of Jesus' people, Jesus' sheep, is love. The identifying marker of Jesus' sheep is love. When this shepherd is separating the sheep from the goats and he's looking for his sheep, he's not saying, which one of you are doing some good loving today? You're over there. And which one of you have been unkind? You're over here. He's actually looking around for the identifying marker of his people. They are marked by love. Specifically, loving his church. And we can see that that should be an identifying marker for someone who is connected to Jesus. I'll give you an example, a story I heard. A guy who was quite anti the church, he was known to refer to Christians amongst his friends as vegetables. That was his little joking way. I don't really know. He wasn't saying it in an uplifting kind of way. It was a demeaning thing. He could refer to them as vegetables. One day he became a Christian. He accepted Jesus. He came to the truth of the gospel. That same day, he just happened to fly out of town for work, and he was in another town, and he came across a street preacher. And he speaks about such a profound experience when he heard a street preacher for the first time after he became a Christian. There was a total shift in his attitude towards that man. Suddenly, he had a new interest in what he was saying. Suddenly, he had a new affection for the message that was being preached. He talked to that man afterwards, stayed around, had a chat to him, and in chatting, the street preacher just said to him, oh, like, how long have you been a Christian? And he was like, just like 12 hours I've been a Christian. And he just says how incredible it was that his attitude towards someone who is a follower of Christ changed so radically. There is a natural thing there, but there's also a transforming thing there that the good news about Jesus does. And so there's a natural thing that might say those that love Jesus should love his people, should love his church. The identifying marker of the sheep is they're identified with love, and specifically love for God's people. And it's a tangible love. This is a tangible love. So gospel-shaped mercy is something that it starts at home amongst God's people, and it's a tangible thing. Look at some of the examples we get of what love looks like. This is what it doesn't say. It doesn't say the sheep were people who loved the church, which the way they showed that was they sung real loud, especially when their favourite song came on Sundays, and they were regular and showed up all the time. Those are things that we do as a community, but they're not the identifying markers of love. This loving the church is loving people, not kind of the institution, and it's a tangible kind of love. It's feeding, it's clothing, it's visiting. That's the picture of what love looks like. And it starts at home and amongst Christians. And while this passage doesn't say it, we know that it shouldn't stay there. It shouldn't stop with just Christians. The way the Bible talks about the kind of love we should show isn't, it should flow out of our love for each other to the world around us. We just finished looking at the letter to the church in Galatia, to Galatians. And early in that letter, Paul says that he has a challenge with the leaders in Jerusalem about their doctrine, about their beliefs. They agree with him and they send him back out to the churches. They say, okay, we agree, actually we're on the same page. Why don't you go out to the churches again? Paul says in Galatians 2, their only added thing was, just make sure you love the poor and needy as you go. Paul says, that's the exact thing I was keen to do anyway. Great. We're on the page with that as well. We're same page with that as well. And he headed out. At the end of the letter, chapter 6, this is what he says to the church. He says, therefore, whenever we have the opportunity, we should do good to everyone. And then he says, especially to those in the family of faith. This is a tangible love that starts with loving God's people, but it shouldn't stop there. It shouldn't end there. It's something that should flow out to the world around us. What does that kind of love look like? This story gives us a real, you know, real practical examples. It's of course not an exhaustive list. Jesus isn't listing all the things that we can do for love, but I want to just, you know, spend a bit of time looking at this list of things. There's six things that this group shows love in: feeding the hungry, drink for the thirsty, housing for the stranger, clothing for the naked, visiting the sick and visiting those in prison. Or originally he says caring for the sick, visiting in prison. Later in the story he says visiting the sick and in prison, those in prison. Those are six kind of practical things. If we, you know, just to break that up a little bit, there's two clear categories I think we can see in that. The first one is an opportunity to be part of the solution. Some of these tangible acts of love are actually contributing to helping someone in their place of need. So someone who is hungry, actually giving them some food is being part of the solution. Someone who is naked, giving them clothing. Someone who is a stranger, giving them housing. That's part of being part of the solution. And there's ways that we can think about that in our own lives. We can extend it from those examples. If we think about what we do within our community, there's ways that we can show tangible love. And we do some of these things all the time. So we sometimes prepare meals together, as in we invite people to help contribute towards meals for someone who is sick, or sometimes we do it for people that have just had a baby and helping out with people that way. So we do that in our community. I think that's something I want to encourage you to keep doing. Sometimes we organise it more centrally. Sometimes it's much more organic, but it's something we want to be doing as a church, loving each other, caring for each other in that tangible way in our community. We also want that to flow out around us. That is why we're doing this Anglicare jackets and blankets, an opportunity for us to actually be part of the solution, to give to those in need. Another great example, I think, there's moments like that pop up here, there we can contribute to, but I think a helpful thing is to think about long-term giving towards something like that. I think things like a sponsor child can be a really helpful way to kind of commit towards helping people in need and making a long-term commitment. Something we've done with our children from a very young age is they both have, we call them sponsor siblings. So we sponsor a boy, Jet's age, and a girl, Olive's age. From a young age, they've sent drawings back and forth between the sponsor sibling and them, and we contribute that way. I think that can be a helpful way to even get kids involved in kind of understanding how we are doing that. So there's ways we can be part of the solution. There are times where we can't be part of the solution. In fact, the examples we're given here, the two ones in this category, are, you know, caring for the sick, and I mean, we can care for the sick to some extent, but we actually can't always help people get better. And people in prison, particularly, I think, in Jesus' day, there's much more thinking about persecution and Christians that are in prison for their faith. But there's times where people are in a situation like that where we can't help them out. So rather than being part of the solution, I think we're called much more to be part of the journey, where we show love to people in our time and care for them. That happens in our church when we spend time with people, and amongst our community, there's so many different pressures and sickness and mental health things that we can give time to each other and love each other in that way. Sometimes giving time to people outside the church is much trickier to find opportunities there. I think things like short-term and even long-term mission is exactly that. Some of the translation mission work that happens around the world, people translate Bibles into local languages, takes years and years and years. Actually, some of the most significant part of that ministry is living amongst those people that time and doing life with them, sharing Jesus through life with them over that time is such a significant part of that ministry. Short-term missions, going to help build something like a hospital or some sort of clinic that cares for people, are ways that we can be part of the journey, even if we can't be part of the solution. I think even our own playtime ministry fits in this category. One of the greatest needs in our area, one of the greatest needs is with family relationships. Some of the biggest reasons for pressure in life for people, I mean, you talk about kind of the big life pressures, you got job and finance. One of the big ones is significantly family and the pressures of parenting and those sorts of stresses. And our playtime ministry offers an opportunity just to sit alongside people and be part of the journey. That is part of what we're doing at that ministry. And so many times those conversations, I hear stories of those conversations that are talking about life and a way of showing genuine love to people by giving some level of respite in caring, connecting with other, particularly mums, but other parents, and kids socialising, is just a way that we can be part of the journey in caring for people. This is what we are called to, and we want to feel the weight. I think there's a part of us that feels like the needs of a broken world are far beyond something we can solve, and there's so much we could do. And I think we sometimes feel the guilt of not doing enough. Sometimes we should feel a healthy weight that we can contribute more. These are things that we are called to do. What's important we get from this passage is this is something that flows out of who we are, not because we're trying to earn some kind of brownie points with God, but we're not doing these things so that the shepherd might include us as part of the sheep. We're doing these things because we identify with the shepherd. We are marked with his love, and that love should flow out of us. As we think about that, we ask the question, how do we grow in that kind of mercy? And the key answer to that is that it's something God works in us. And so pointing our hearts to him is the greatest way, the only transforming way, eternally transforming way to grow in that mercy. And so we're going to transition now in our service. We're going to spend a bit of time reflecting on what it is Jesus has done. So we're going to move into a time of communion together.